Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Historic levels of flooding. That is the big story across much of the Midwest today. The heavy snow that fell during last week's bomb cyclone melted quickly. And now all that water is flooding highways, farms, and homes in parts of Iowa, Wisconsin, and Nebraska. At least two people have died in Nebraska. Lisa Lemus lives in Paradise Lakes, Nebraska, south of Omaha. And here she is speaking to a reporter from KETV.
That's about as bad as it gets. You know, you're starting all over. We're 50 years old, and this is going to be a new start, I guess.
Let's check in with Bill Kelly. He's a reporter with member station NET Radio in Nebraska. Bill, welcome.
Nice to speak with you.
I'm looking at a photo that the governor's office tweeted out. It's of the Spencer Dam that was destroyed by an 11-foot wall of water in central Nebraska. It looks like it has been bombed out. What can you tell us about that and about the power of these floods?
I think what's significant is that you have an area up in north central Nebraska where Spencer Dam was, but you have to repeat images similar to that all the way across 250 miles of north central, northeast Nebraska, and then bring it down to the Missouri River, down from Sioux City, Omaha, and all the way down to the Missouri River. So it's almost an L shape that's been affected by this. It's a huge area, and really no one image captures it, because what happened was all the snow that you mentioned from the bomb cyclone that ended up filling dozens, hundreds of small creeks, rivers, and all those flooded for the first time in anybody's memory. Everything flooded at once. They're now feeding into the Platte, Missouri River, and that's causing all these flood problems.
I'm also seeing pictures of roads completely wiped out, bridges completely gone. I spoke with Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts earlier today. Here's his description of the damage.
We have the most widespread flooding damage, at least in a half century, and maybe in our entire state's history. Major river systems such as the Niobrara, the Platte, the Elkhorn, the Loup River, the Missouri River are all at record flood stages, and it is just creating widespread devastation.
So sounds like that's stacking up with what you've seen. But as you go out and talk to people and see this damage yourself, what are you hearing?
There are a couple of things that are noteworthy. First of all, because there's all these small individual towns of 1,500, 800, maybe 5,000, 6,000, they're all dealing with this on an individual basis across this huge area. And one of the major factors, you mentioned the roads and bridges being washed out, that's making part of the relief effort very difficult, because it's so difficult to get from point A to point B across these areas in Nebraska. A lot of the paved roads are washed out, and that's leaving people off to the gravel and dirt roads that are ordinarily used for agriculture primarily. And those are starting to take a beating just because of the traffic. And that's going to be a huge expense. And what worries the people in these towns is that there's this huge amount of relief that's going to be necessary to fix those resources, and how much money is going to be left over for homeowners and businesses in either direct relief or low-interest loans and the like.
We're also seeing that parts of the interstate that cut across all the way across Nebraska are shut down as well. How much havoc is that causing as people try to move around?
I-80 is completely open, and there were only a fairly short period over the weekend that the crossings near the Missouri River were affected. Most of the mobility issues are up in the more rural areas north of I-80. And so traversing the state is okay right now. It's getting from town to town.
Okay. So for people who are completely cut off by these floodwaters, what's in store for them? I know in those situations, it can be very difficult to get something as simple as clean water to drink.
Clean water is going to be a huge issue because these floods in many cases overwhelmed sewer systems, broke main water lines from the well systems, and so many are under boiled water orders or are getting pallets and pallets of bottled water at this point. And it could be some time before they're able to use their municipal water supplies again.
And just quickly, Bill, is the worst over? Is the water starting to recede or what?
The water actually started to recede in a lot of areas over the weekend as it drew down into the Missouri River Basin. There are still problems down at the Missouri border in the far southeast corner of the state, but most of it, most of the cleanup now is going to be clear for the next couple of days. There's some rain, but not very much.
Bill Kelly with NET Radio. Thanks.
So flooding in the Midwest, it's been a wet winter in California, and that has led to a super bloom of wildflowers and now swarms of painted lady butterflies. The black and orange insects usually keep a low profile as they migrate from the deserts of western Mexico to their breeding grounds in Oregon, but this year they are hard to miss. Scientists say the number in the millions, maybe billions, as they make their mass migration through California. Joining us is Pat Flanagan, co-founder and CEO of the nonprofit Butterfly Farms based in Encinitas, California. Hi, Pat.
Hey, good morning.
And first of all, just give us a sense of what it is like there right now when we say millions, maybe even billions of butterflies.
Well, we just, you know, it started out with a few painted ladies going by several weeks ago. I was at work talking to my assistant co-founder, Tom Merriman, and I saw a painted lady go by and I said, well, you know, maybe this is the start of the migration. Let's keep an eye out. And sure enough, it just every day it picked up. And I've never seen it between the super bloom and the butterflies flying through last weekend out in our local desert was the most spectacular days I've ever had out there. The way I explain it to people, it's like being in a snow globe of painted lady butterflies. It was just a very surreal, phenomenal experience that we don't get to see every day.
And the reason it's happening this year is just because it's been so wet, and so there's a lot of food for them to eat, basically.
Correct. I mean, you know, here in San Diego, we can have years of, you know, just a couple inches of rain, even out at the coast. And our deserts, while quite beautiful, are exceptionally dry and can see only just a couple inches in the entire season. Well, you know, we have places in our desert that saw year totals in one day. Coachella Valley saw 3.5 inches on Valentine's Day. We had snow in the desert. There's pictures of, you know, snow on Joshua Tree and certain places around here. So we had a very exceptionally wet weather event this winter, and the plant world has responded, and when the plants take off like that, then we see the explosion of insects. And this is not just going to be painted ladies. There's other things that are going to follow, but it's painted ladies right now.
And when you look at the overall butterfly population, last year in California, it actually saw a sharp decrease. The monarch population dipped 86% to a record low. Does this help to replenish some of those numbers?
No, because this is a different butterfly species, and that's a great point. While everybody's out enjoying the butterflies the last couple weeks here in California, let me tell you, my phone's been ringing off the hook, and it's all over social media, and every news organization, you know, in the Western Hemisphere is calling. But we can't lose sight of the fact that our monarch population, we just received our numbers from last November's count. We saw them in December or January that we were down 86% on the previous year's monarch count. So no, our butterfly populations are declining. And so this we can't lose sight of the fact that there's so much work to do.
Now, I don't want to look only at the bad side of what's going on here, because I'm sure it's really wonderful for everybody to see these painted lady butterflies. But I wonder if they are showing up in such big numbers in a place where there's typically not the kind of plant life that they need, does it screw up their migration patterns at all for next year?
No, I don't think so. So this is a butterfly that's all over the world, first of all. They're a butterfly that is not in trouble, let's say that. Mm-hmm. And they also can expand and retract the size of their population very, very vastly. So the number between what we'll see this year and next year could be completely different. But since they use about 100 different host plants, their ability to reproduce is not in jeopardy right now. So they'll fly to where they need to go, and that's what they're doing right now. They'll reproduce there, and then they'll head back. And so that's the beauty of nature. You know, Mother Nature knows what she's doing. They're headed in the right direction. They're headed towards food. There's plenty of food out there for them right now, so we're good.
So when it comes to the monarchs, which, as you mentioned, are having a problem with their population, is there anything, while people are focusing so much on butterflies, is there anything that can be done to help the ones that are in trouble?
Yeah, that's a great question and a great point. So what anybody can do to get involved, especially with monarch issues, is plant habitat. And habitat for monarch butterflies is milkweed. It's a plant that, you know, was hard to find 20 years ago, but it's much, much easier to find now. Almost anybody can call around and find milkweed that's appropriate for their area. Plant it in your garden. Monarch butterflies will come. They'll reproduce. You know, go to your garden center, get milkweed, and plant it in your garden and help the monarchs.
That is Pat Flanagan, co-founder and CEO of Butterfly Farms in California. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
There's a new book out this month about population of the world and its countries, how it advances and recedes like a tide because of births, deaths, and migration. It's called The Human Tide, How Population Shaped the Modern World, and its author, Paul Moreland, joins us from London. Welcome.
Hello.
And let's start with the title of your book, The Human Tide. You write in this book about how human population is kind of like a tide with ebbs and flows.
Absolutely. Historically, populations have knocked around in a rather random fashion. And then starting at the beginning of the 19th century in Britain and America, and then progressively around the rest of the world, the whole thing started to take on a pattern that we call the demographic transition. And that meant, first of all, that death rates came down as people got a bit of education, a bit of public health, maybe a bit of private health. They lived longer. They didn't die like flies anymore, but they were still breeding like rabbits. So lots of people arriving, not many people departing, and huge population growth. Gradually, people adjust their fertility rates down when they see their kids surviving, when they become even more educated, when they become more urbanized, and the population starts to level off. And that happens at different places, different times, kicks off in the UK and in the United States, and then it goes to other parts of Europe, and then it goes global.
The three things that you point out are the drivers of population are birth rate, death rate, and migration. So let's look at the first one, birth rate. Right now, where is it highest and what's driving it?
It's highest in countries which are very traditional, you might say pre-modern. So there are still countries in West Africa particularly where women don't have access to contraceptions. And that would be places like Chad and even slightly more advanced countries like Nigeria and Uganda. Women still have on average 6 or 7 kids. And outside Africa, almost nowhere has a fertility rate more than 4. And almost all the developed world, it's 2 or below.
And you're saying that a big part of that is just lack of education and therefore lack of the use of birth control.
If you don't have the education, you probably won't seek out the birth control. So the two tend to go together.
Where is the birth rate very low and what's behind that?
It's low in what I call the infertile crescent, which is like a vast area from Portugal to Singapore, a little bit higher in the States and Canada, a little bit higher in Northern Europe. But if you go through Southern Europe, countries with traditionally high fertility rates like Spain and Italy, if you go through all of Eastern Europe, Russia, and now China, Japan, and even still relatively poor countries like Thailand, women have decided they don't want large families, and it's well below replacement level. It's also below replacement level in places you wouldn't expect it, such as majority Muslim countries like Iran and Lebanon.
Why is that?
Well, in part, it's a process of modernization. It's high levels of urbanization and education. But there's something more going on. I mean, why do women in Vermont, for example, have a lot fewer children than women in South Dakota? Once you're through that process of modernization, it sort of ceases to be an economically driven thing, and it becomes a cultural thing.
What about the second part of it, which is basically life expectancy? It is getting higher all around the world, but where do you see it longest right now and shortest?
The longest pretty much is Japan, and places like the US and to some extent the UK are surprising given all our other positive economic and social indicators. We're not quite at the cutting edge and we may even be retreating a little bit, but that's very recent and difficult to understand. But in Japan, it's well over 80, and in countries like the UK and the US and most of the developed world, it's around 80. Around the 40s, the average Mexican lived 20 years less than the average American, 50 versus 70, say. Today, the average Mexican perhaps lives 2 or 3 years less than the average American. So where places are the worst for life expectancy, they've made the most progress.
But is that a problem if life expectancy is going up? Because you look at a country like Japan, and almost everybody looks at it and says they've got a real population problem. They're not growing.
So let's separate those two things for a moment. The long life expectancy in Japan itself is the result of excellent education, excellent healthcare, and so on. Mm-hmm. If it's combined with long periods of low fertility, which we've seen in Japan and other countries, then you end up with an, on average, very old population. Now, that has good things and bad things. The good things are about peace. Old populations don't go to war. The bad thing is all the pressures on the welfare state, on pensions, on healthcare, on the workforce and on the economy.
You've got to have young people to support those older people.
You have. And indeed, you also have to have young people to be entrepreneurial, to take risks.
Let's talk about what you just said there about older populations being more peaceful. You point out that Switzerland is a very peaceful country and it's an older country, whereas Yemen, for example, is a very young country. A lot of people having a lot of children. And it is obviously in the midst of a war at the moment.
Yeah, and those are anecdotes, but they're sort of typical of the data. The data shows that the older a country is, the more peaceful it is. And the example I often give is I spend a lot of time in French Catalonia. I went over the border to Spanish Catalonia not that long ago. And in Spanish Catalonia, as perhaps your listeners know, they had a referendum for independence. Mm-hmm. It was won. Madrid didn't accept it. It crushed it. In other countries, you might have got a civil war. You didn't get a civil war in Catalonia because the average age is in the mid-40s. And people are just too old to take to the hills with their Armalites. You go there and you see lots of elderly people sitting around sipping coffee. It's not going to be a civil war situation.
Right, and having their siesta, which of course is not a civil war situation either.
Siestas are not good for civil wars, right. No.
What about migration? A big factor in demographics. And in fact, I think you could say that in the United States, it has been the big driver of population growth. Is not the fact that people in America are having tons of children. It's that there are so many people coming in from all over the world.
Well, migration is the huge factor that's going on at the moment. And in many ways, it's the result of economics, but it's also the result of different demographic profiles of different countries. So that underlying demography, relatively low fertility rates in the developed world with a huge appetite for labor and high fertility rates in the developing world, attracting people in, has caused huge ethnic change. And that it in turn is driving a whole load of phenomena we see from Trump to Brexit to the rise of the alternative right in Europe, in places like Italy, Poland and Hungary.
So with all the research that you have done on this, countries don't have so much control over their birth and death rate, but they do have control over their migration policies. What do you think is the ideal situation for a country that wants to be vibrant, that wants to have a growing economy, and that wants to have a real future when it comes to migration?
I think migration is something that each country must decide for itself. So in the UK, we have had no ability to control our immigration from within the European Union. And if we get to Brexit, that will change. And that's become a huge issue. So I think the most important thing is that there is some democratic control, because I think that keeps the forces of reaction and racism under control when people feel they are actually controlling these things. In terms of what governments can do, if they want to bring their fertility rate down, because they're Chad or Nigeria, there's lots they can do in terms of making sure women get an education and access to contraception. If they want their fertility rates to go up, it's much more difficult to achieve, but there are things you can do in terms of making women's lives in the workplace, combining that with families, easier, and in terms of tax incentives. But the impact there is marginal.
Do you think that when we hear about a country kind of dying, like Japan, like Italy, where they don't have a high enough birth rate or migration rate to keep up with the times, that's a problem?
it's a problem for those countries, and it's a result of their choices. It's the collective result of their fertility choices. And then they have to decide, do they want to remain with low fertility, low migration, and all the economic problems that brings? Or do they want to accelerate inward migration and all the questions of politics and integration that brings? Or are they actually going to produce more children? But that takes rather a long time to feed through to a growing workforce.
But how long does it take for a country to basically die off if they don't do those things?
Well, the very last person would be a very, very long time. But I mean, if a country's population halves, first of all, that country will be an old country by definition, and it's constantly dragging down its economy. And it's very interesting that Japan really hit the buffers economically exactly when its workforce peaked in about 1989 and it started to go down. And that was the end of the Japanese economic miracle. And as we speak, the workforce in China is now on the turn. And that may give rise to very big challenges to the Chinese economy. And China and Japan are not countries that have got an ability or a tradition to suck in and integrate vast numbers of immigrants in the way the United States has done so successfully.
So, Paul Moreland, if you were to look ahead right now, tell me something about the world in 30 years that I don't know at this moment.
Well, I say in the book, the world is going to be more grey, more green and less white. More grey, we're all going to be older and probably more peaceful. Every society's aging. More green, I think there's real potential for environmental reclaiming of land for nature as our population growth slows. So globally, we were growing at 2% a year in the 70s. Now globally, we're growing at 1% a year and it's slowing down all the time. And that makes some real possibility for some of the pressure to be taken off resources. And finally, less white. The population of Africa is booming. Traditional white countries such as the United States or Europe have very low, if any, indigenous population growth and will either decline or require immigration or need to change their ways in terms of family size.
And we're at about 7 billion total world population right now. Where will we be?
We're getting a bit above that. And I think we may, you know, the general consensus is we'll gradually go up to 11 billion, which sounds like a lot, but we're getting there in proportional terms much more slowly at half the pace we were 40 years ago. And that pace will continue to slow as more and more countries become like Britain or America with pretty low fertility rates and already quite long life expectancy.
That is Paul Moreland, whose new book is called The Human Tide, How Population Shaped the Modern World. Very interesting, Paul. Thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting me.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The massive college admissions scandal recently uncovered by the FBI exposed how wealthy families paid bribes to get their kids into elite schools. And the story has prompted a question from CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Is college even worth it anymore? Jill, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. And explain why you're asking that question, because there are studies that say men and women with a college degree earn hundreds of thousands of dollars more in their lifetime than people who just graduated from high school.
Absolutely true. And so we know that a college degree can pay off for a lot of kids. And as you said, 900,000 more in median lifetime earnings for men and 630,000 for women. We'll talk about that wage gap at a different time. Right? But I will say this. This really started to get me thinking, this whole scandal about what we are paying and what lengths we are going to as families to really attain these degrees. We want our kids to be educated. We want them to be competitive in the workforce. But is this really, all this energy and money really worth it? And that's the question that I've been trying to noodle around quite a bit.
Some of the parents in question here paid more than $1 million to get their kids into elite schools for these bribes. Are you saying that in some ways, those degrees that they were so desperately seeking weren't really worth that much to those families.
Well, here's the thing. We know that these elite schools can offer fantastic financial rewards, but the rewards really do differ depending on where you start. So there's an analysis that found that if the student's family was already at the top of the income heap, like those involved in this scandal, the student was not likely to catapult any further with a fancy degree versus a less prestigious one, which really means that these parents not only broke the law, but also made a really bad wager, which is they could have opened the door for their kids in any way they wanted to in the future without paying through the nose for that college degree.
And what about kids who are not from wealthy families? I mean, what
Where we know that those elite schools absolutely pay off, because if you start at the middle to lower income spectrum, you do jump up in terms of your lifetime earnings pretty dramatically with those elite schools. And of course, I should note that those elite schools can also mean the difference between gaining entry into those elite business and law school and medical school programs as well.
Jill, what you're saying might be even more offensive to some people, that these families don't necessarily need the elite schools to cement their elevated place in the world. And meanwhile, the people who would benefit from it even more are left out.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And I think that this is the real critical question of higher ed right now. Have we created a system? Are we part of a system that really automatically tilts towards those who already have versus those who don't? It also means that if you are in the middle and you are piling on gobs and gobs of debt, you really need to be careful about the school and the tuition and the actual degree you're ending up with and what field of study you're entering. It is incredible to see how many students and their families are impoverishing themselves for a degree that does not pay off in the long term.
Well, this story has struck a nerve. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money, will link you to the story where you pose this question: is college even worth it anymore? Jill, thanks so much.
Take care.
What is the best measure of the economy? Is it the GDP number from the government, which told us the U.S. economy grew 2.6% in the fourth quarter of last year? Is it the unemployment rate, 3.8% at last check? Is it the stock market, which is once again near record highs? Or is it something else? Well, our next guest thinks it should be what he calls economic dignity. Gene Sperling was the director of the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama. He joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So how do you define economic dignity, first of all?
You know, when you're looking at your end goal for economic policy, it shouldn't be some arcane metric. You really should be asking as a policymaker, what on someone's deathbed would they say mattered most in their economic life? And so I define this sense of economic dignity as having three pillars. One, through your contribution, were you able to not only care for your family, but were you able to experience the most natural and equal and wonderful joys of family, or were you denied them by economic deprivation? Mm-hmm. So that's the first pillar. The second is an ability to pursue your potential and purpose is fundamental to that sense of economic dignity. And third, could you contribute in the economy at work with respect as opposed to domination or humiliation? You know, if you look at the Me Too movement, what you saw were a lot of particularly women who were either pursuing their ability to care for their family or even, you know, high potential in the entertainment field. Mm-hmm. But the price of that was a sense of humiliation, domination, powerlessness that's not captured in any economic metric, but matters deeply to a person's life. And so my view is, that's what we should be focusing on.
So you talk about asking these questions on a deathbed. How do you measure it along the way, though? Because wouldn't anyone going through life have to go through ups and downs? And at a certain point, they may have a job that they don't like and feel that they don't have economic dignity, but maybe it's a stepping stone to a point where they will.
Well, one of the things I say is that government and even the best economic policy cannot guarantee happiness, and we will all go through disappointments. But I talk about a sense of basic economic dignity. So in terms of care for family, I mean, those are policy issues. If you're somebody in our country who works full time, can you not only raise your family with a degree of security, but are you able to actually be there for the sick relative or the sick child? Whether health care is a right, what our minimum wage is, you know, those things matter very deeply. Secondly, when I talk about pursuit of potential, a lot of what I talk about there is the need for second chances. So that assumes that there will be times you'll lose jobs, you'll face dislocation. But we are a country who supports the value that the accident of your birth shouldn't affect the outcome of your life. But when it comes to policy, we actually don't come through. We're probably one of the worst countries in the world in actually helping people if they suffer a major job loss or career loss or have a spell in the prison system. When we don't give people second chances, it's bad for economic growth. We lose their potential, but we also hurt something deeper in people. And I think when you look at the number of deaths of despair, addiction, suicide, a lot of that is not just about your wage or whether you could get a job, but whether you still have the capacity and opportunity to feel a sense of potential and purpose. And when you look at the movements that led in the progressive era, it wasn't always about just did you have a job or what your wage was. It was whether you were treated in an arbitrary way, where you did you feel abused. You may not have the job you love. It may not pay as much as you'd like. It may not be everything. But you should have an economy and policies that give workers the power to stand up for themselves, even with the ups and downs and disappointments of life.
So what do you make of the fact that in 2016, a lot of people in this country who felt that they had been let down in the economy, that maybe they didn't have the dignity that they wanted, ended up going not to the people that you worked for, the Democrats, but to President Trump, that he gave them the message that they wanted to hear?
Well, the way I would look at that is that when we fail to have a true compact on economic dignity, it opens the door for somebody like a Donald Trump to then appeal to that sense of being left behind, not with positive or unifying policy measures, but it leaves an opening to play on resentment and fear and division. Certainly, there were a lot of people who felt that way. But the problems with economic dignity are much deeper. And I think when I look at like domestic workers or people in care jobs, those are often women of color. They're often women who speak a second language. And you don't think about them as being connected with perhaps the dislocated steel worker. But there is something in common. There is a loss of economic dignity when they're in work situations where either they're feeling abused or they're feeling that their country is not committing enough to giving them true second chances. So the best thing we can do is respond to that with the right type of policies and opportunities, as opposed to leaving a vacuum that can be filled with the type of things that divide us. And it's upon all of us to provide a better alternative.
Okay, so let me go through some of the alternatives that are coming out right now, some of the proposals that Democrats are looking at to help lift people up in this economy and maybe give them that economic dignity that you're talking about. What do you think about the idea of Medicare for all?
So what I stress is that your focus is on what is the end impact on people. So what I think is just wonderful about those who call for Medicare for all is that they're fundamentally focusing on an end goal that healthcare should be a right, that it should be available, that we shouldn't see a parent with the deep pain of not being able to provide for a child with a serious illness or worrying they would bankrupt their family. In my view, you focus on that end goal, and Medicare for all can be one way to get there, but we're not open to people accepting, for example, the status quo, where so many millions of people's economic dignity is threatened on a daily basis by lack of health security.
What about universal basic income, the idea that everybody would have, from the government, at least a bare minimum of income?
Well, that is an issue in my article where I do offer a different vision. And what I argue is that we should not give up on this sense of a compact of contribution. It's not that we should only help people based on whether they have a job. But I do think it is deep in our country to ask everybody to carry their load, to do their share. And so I see more, let's have a strong dignity wage. If you work, there should be a high minimum wage, $15. There should be child care. There should be a broader earned income tax credit. We should help out and maybe have basic income for the poorest families or those with disabilities. Instead of writing everybody just a check, give more people funds and support to have the skills to do a job that gives dignity to others. There are families across our country who need somebody with skills who can help their parent or grandparent with dementia, who can help their child with autism. So rather than just give people a check, I would have a double dignity jobs corps where we're supporting people contributing to another person's economic dignity. And that was the beauty of how Martin Luther King talked about this, that all jobs have dignity because they allow you to serve your fellow person.
I just want to finally ask you, if you were to take your proposal and drop it off at the, you know, Republican congressional lunch, I would imagine that many people would say, oh, here we go again. The liberals just want to spend more money and not, you know, stick with our capitalist system where everybody just has to work for what they get. Well, how do you respond to that argument?
Well, again, the vision I have is not just handing out checks. It is fundamentally based around work. So I think if I started perhaps talking to some conservatives, and I said, don't you believe that if a person works hard and does everything they could, that they should be able to raise their children, retire, and take care of their parents with a sense of dignity? I think people would say yes. When you talked about the end goal, I think you unify people more, and maybe we can unify on end goals of economic dignity, and that will open up more room for people to have a good faith debate about the best means to get there.
That is Gene Sperling, who was director of the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama. We will link you to his article about economic dignity at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lyft is starting its public relations roadshow today as it tries to court investors for a $23 billion initial public offering. Shares of the ride-hailing company could start trading by next week, and Lyft's competitor, Uber, is expected to go public next month. Ahead of that news, Uber is expanding its rewards program to more than 100 cities in the United States. It could be good news for loyal customers looking to score free rides, or bad news for cities that are worried about traffic congestion. David Zipper joins us now. He's a resident fellow at the German Marshall Fund in Washington, D.C. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You are not a fan. Why?
Well, I think it's a smart move for Uber because it will make people potentially be more loyal to the company at a time when, you know, Uber is getting ready to go public. But for cities, I worry that the structure of Uber Rewards is designed to give an incentive, maybe a small one, maybe a larger one, we just don't know yet, for riders to take individual trips instead of the pooled rides that Uber itself agrees would lead to less congestion. So in other words, Uber Rewards is designed to nudge people into taking their own trips, which will put more cars and vehicles on the streets.
Instead of sharing a ride, as you say, in Uber Pool, this is when strangers could be riding with you in a vehicle. So let's go through some of these perks. No fee cancellations, car upgrades, guaranteed prices to your favorite destinations, cashback rewards. But Uber says you do get reward points for using Uber Pool.
You do. But the fact is you get double the rewards points for every dollar that you spend if you take UberX, which is that's probably their most popular service where people are going to take an individual trip. And of course, an UberX trip is going to already be a little bit more expensive than an Uber Pool trip. So that means you're actually looking at potentially a 4X increase in your rewards points if you decide to take an UberX trip instead of an Uber Pool trip between two points.
How does this compare to, say, an airline frequent flyer program? Is there any difference?
There's some similarities. And, you know, just like with an airline frequent flyer program, you'll get more points if you get, say, a first class ticket. That's fine because societally there's not much of a difference if you buy a first-class ticket or an economy plus seat. That's different, though, with ride-hail. And because with ride-hail for Uber or a service like Lyft, if you're going to take Uber Pool, you're going to have less of a carbon footprint, if you will. You're going to put fewer cars on the street because you're sharing your ride, as opposed to if you took an individual trip on Uber X or Uber Black or something like that. So that's why I think society probably doesn't need to worry too much about how frequent flyer programs are set up by the airlines. We probably do need to be concerned about what might happen as a result of Uber Rewards as it nudges people to take individual trips.
So on the roads then, how much extra traffic are we talking about because of this?
So that is a great question. When I spoke to some people who sort of defended the Uber Rewards program, the attitude was, no one's really going to care about this. You know, no one really makes their trip decision between whether to take a pooled ride or an individual trip based on rewards. You know, maybe, we just don't know yet, but I don't know about you, but I myself have been known at various points in my life to get very excited about getting frequent flyer tickets.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to pay probably irrationally more for a given flight if I can be on the airline that gets me the points that I want. So it's possible that we'll see no impact from this. It's also possible we really could see people be nudged away from pooled rides. We'll have to look at the data, but there's no way in my mind that the Uber Rewards program is going to actually be a net win for cities. All it could do is either be neutral or be bad for congestion.
Well, it is true that people do not use those pooled rides simply because they don't want to be in a car with another person. So yes, we will see whether or not it nudges people away from that or not. Cities like Washington, D.C., where you are right now, have terrible congestion problems. What do you think cities should be thinking about in relation to this?
Well, cities have leverage. You know, if evidence comes out, and I do hope there'll be studies soon to see if Uber and frankly also Lyft are taking actions, then cities or states for that matter could consider using their regulatory and taxation powers to compensate for that. You know, if you have to pay an extra dollar or two to take an individual trip as opposed to Uber Pool because that's the city requirement through tax legislation, you know, that's probably enough of a push to overcome whatever nudge rewards might create for you to take an individual trip.
That's David Zipper, resident fellow at the German Marshall Fund in Washington, D.C. David, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
And we reached out to Uber for a response to David's concerns that this rewards program could cause more traffic in cities. A spokesman told us Uber Rewards was designed so that both the most frequent riders who use low-cost options and riders who regularly ride with higher-cost products have an opportunity to get rewarded. By the way, Lyft is also starting to roll out a rewards program of its own. Let us know what you think at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.